Welcome to episode 230 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have a good friend, Charlotte, on the program. She's been on before. It's been a while, but we're happy to have her back. We talk with this activist poet about the Mariner East 2 pipeline in Pennsylvania and the White Pine Camp's resistance to it. We talk about the economic issues, the environmental issues, the societal issues, and how hard it is sometimes to be a non-profit, geared, driven activist. We also have on this week's program an EW essay by yours truly titled Calamity. We have a wonderful short article by the writer Hallie Cantor titled The Writer's Process from a recent New Yorker magazine issue. And we have a poem titled Bob. All of this is complemented by, as is usually the case, several great tunes. So nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 230 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. I am a killer of hopes and dreams. I am a purveyor of greed through spectacular machines. I am a warmonger and despot, demanding high praise, obedience, and esteem. I am the oppressor, breeding fear and anger in the dilated pupils of a young person's innocent eyes. I am the warrior of personality, and the confidant of ignorance, the woeful conspirer of a banal existence. I will confound, manipulate, and inspire you to illogical leaps of fate. And underlying it all is a cynical design template, fueled with the substance of an ingrate, more driven by an id than a superego. Ergo, this is how I pay the rent, how I can elude and circumvent any truer responsibility for my own personal quagmire of personhood. I bury my discontent deep into your soul, polluting any chance of you understanding your essence, crafting lofty goals, visualizing a clear, healthy sense of who you might be. Instead, I leave you grappling with the basest challenges and impulses of your humanity. I am a natural calamity.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Oh, where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. Rain's gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? Oh, what did you hear, my darling young one? Heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. Heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. Dark forest where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding their waters, where the home in the valley meets the damn dirty prison, where the executioner's face is well hidden. speak it and breathe it. I reflect it from the mountain so all souls can see it. And I stand on the ocean until I start sinking. I'll know my song well before I start singing.
Hello, is this Charlotte?
Yes, it is. Hello, EW Conundrum.
It's nice to hear your voice again.
Yeah, same to you. It's been a little while, so it's good to be back on and just hear your voice too.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking the time out, ladies and gentlemen. Charlotte, she is many things, but we'll call her activist and poet right now. And we're going to get into some really interesting discussion, I'm sure. We're going to start off with something you're involved with. It's the White Pine Camp, its resistance of Mariner East 2 pipeline. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay. And I'll try not to be pedantic. Because it's really hard to talk about it without wanting to tell everything, because there's been so many injustices and things like that. But like I said, I'll try to keep it simple. Mariner East 2 pipelines is running through the southern part of our state, from the shale fields in Ohio and western Pennsylvania to Marcus Hook Refinery in the south of Pennsylvania, about 20 miles south. Mariner East 2 is owned by Sunoco Logistics, whose parent company is Energy Transfer Partners, who is also the main backer of the Dakota Access Pipeline. Energy Transfer Partners, they're the main company responsible for constructing that pipeline. Now, Mariner East 2 is running through Huntington County, which is south central PA, where my friend Elise Gerhardt's family's home is. And they have many acres of forest there. And her mother, Ellen Gerhardt, was also a steward of this forest. And about a year ago, before permits were issued, they started clear cutting their land for pipeline construction. They were allowed to do this by a eminent domain seizure, a condemnation issued by Huntington County Judge George Zanuck, and which the family immediately appealed it after he issued it in December of 2015. And even though they were challenging it in the Philadelphia District Courts with a group, a nonprofit group called Clean Air Council, and it's still an ongoing case. He was able to sort of override that by issuing an emergency injunction to allow them to start clear cutting. So that's when the resistance really began. It started with the tree sit, and of course, other things on the ground that just protests and spreading the word and working with people in the other counties. But yes, that's when it started last year. And the DEP finally issued the permits in February of this year. And those are the earth moving and water crossing permits to allow them to construct the pipeline and make way for the pipeline. After that, even though their case is still an appeal and everything, they are starting construction along the right-of-way, the pipeline right-of-way, and they've already started constructing in their county, so they're just waiting any day now for the sheriff's department to show up and deliver a writ of possession, which is a second emergency injunction that makes it it a lot easier to remove, arrest, and prosecute people. Do you have further questions before
no,
I go on?
No. I mean, the DEP you mentioned, and that's the Department of Environmental Protection for Pennsylvania. You mentioned an emergency injunction. I suppose the emergency, as the court sees it, has to do with economics for the gas company.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want them to lose any money.
Right.
Now, why the resistance to this?
Well, firstly, you know, the thing I already mentioned was that their land was taken by eminent domain. The family, the Gerhardt family, did not want this pipeline running through their land. You know, they have some trees were close to 100 years old. It's mostly an evergreen forest that they have on their home, and many wetlands and streams and that run to the Juniata watershed. So that, you know, just the poisoning of our water resource is a big concern. You know, they hired a private ecological consulting firm to look at their land after Sunoco in one of their permit applications to the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, they marked where all the wetlands and waterways were on their property. And this ecological consulting firm found gross underrepresentation of wetlands and other waterways in their land. And this pipeline isn't even, it's transporting byproducts of natural gas, not even liquid natural gas itself. It's NGLs, or natural gas liquids, mostly like ethane, butane, propane, but most of it is going to be used to be sent to international petrochemical markets for the manufacturing of plastics. And that's over 80% of the NGLs are going to this export terminal. Like, the, you know, this isn't benefiting the state, the citizens of Pennsylvania in any way. And Sunoco has very bad track record with pipelines, accidents and incidents, which is easy to find these statistics on the Pipeline Hazardous Materials and Safety Administration website. It's a federal government program. And but I know that there is at least one pipeline incident per day in the United States. And, you know, there's just pipeline incidents every day throughout the country as pipelines are starting to become more of a presence throughout the country. And even terminals are being built along the coast, like in Cove Point, Maryland. That's going to be, amongst other pipelines, going to be taking liquid natural gas, you know, like the raw stuff, to an export terminal there by the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline that is also running through our state, but many other states. It's a federal pipeline.
You don't see a benefit to the locality where this is occurring. You don't even see a benefit to the state at large, economically maybe, but not directly related to the use of the NGLs. And you also, I suppose, are concerned about the rights of citizens and their private property being overridden by eminent domain and a judicial system that has, it seems, in its set of higher priorities, the financial interests of the gas companies. And all of this stuff, as you mentioned, 80% of it is basically going to international manufacturers for plastics. So am I clear and accurate about your major concerns? On top of it, water poisoning and whatever else might occur with big accidents that regularly happen with pipelines.
Yes, that is true, and thank you for summarizing it and putting it concisely.
Well, those are pretty common concerns, and I think legitimate concerns. I would have to agree with you on those. Why do you think it happens so often? I mean, you mentioned DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline. That's going ahead, basically, despite federal concern at one point during the Obama administration and a real national outpouring of resistance, citizen resistance to that project. Nonetheless, still happening. You know, you're talking about sacred lands for indigenous people. You're talking about water resource contamination potentially. But still, these actions from the courts and state, federal institutions support the gas industry. Why do you think that keeps occurring?
Well, I do want to mention that this has been occurring for a long time, even before the Trump administration. Of course, it's definitely expedited and gotten a lot worse since the Trump administration. Before I get back to that, I just think that it's happening. I mean, just put it simply, just interests in, and ties to the natural gas and oil companies. I mean, I think that industry is still like the most, I mean, this is just my own opinion, but still the most powerful force in the world, even though the presence of renewables is growing and, hopefully everything that was discussed at the Paris Climate Summit will, and afterward, the recent decision between China and the EU to really step it up and respond to climate change. Hopefully that continues to happen and oil and gas will phase out. But, to put it simply, I just think it comes down to dollars for everyone involved. The politicians getting major donations from these industries and such like that.
Well, how do we stop that? How do we stop that? I know you're part of a resistance movement, and there are many, many tentacles to that movement across our continent. How does it work? How are we going to make it work?
That is a very good question. I think that, even though the Dakota Access Pipeline is going forward, their divestment campaign was like really successful, up until the point it was approved again. And like even the divestment campaign in Wells Fargo has been really successful for their, it started mainly for their backing of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But resistance needs to happen at many different levels. And right now what the White Pine Camp is doing is like what the water protectors in the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, and other First Nations were doing at the site, the construction site for the Dakota Access Pipeline. They had to blockade it to stall time to put public pressure on these companies and their elected officials, and also to spread the word and use social media. So I just think it's like all hands on deck, and we're just trying to use what tactics we think are most successful. But honestly, this, like I said, this has been happening, especially in Pennsylvania, with pipelines and fracking since 2007, 2008. And so this resistance has been going a long time in the state, just to the natural gas industry. And it always seemed like the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, when it comes to federal pipelines, because that's interstate commerce, they seem, the DEP and both FERC, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, seem to kind of rubber stamp anything, everything. And
Do you get discouraged? Do you get discouraged as an activist?
Yeah, definitely. I'll be honest, especially since it's, these are all really hard battles to fight, you know, that haven't seen a lot of success in the state. But there have been small victories, and like, you know, we just try to soak that in and learn what worked the best in those situations, and just try to take care of each other and try not to burn out and everything. But it's difficult because, you know, in these rural communities, especially in Pennsylvania, it's hard to mobilize people. I mean, in areas where fracking has been going on a long time, in like Susquehanna and Bradford County, you know, I meet people there who are farmers and hunters and business people, but, you know, most of them, they weren't environmentalists, they weren't activists, but how this affected them, their families, and their neighbors made them want to respond and become active.
How did it, how did it affect them?
Well, especially now, there's so many examples I'm trying to think of, like,
well, generally, I mean, how did you, are they upset because of the landscape? Are they upset because their health has been compromised, traditions, you know, the rural lifestyle has been changed in a way they don't like, things like that?
Yes. Yeah, thank you. Water, drinking water is definitely a big issue in areas where there is fracking, where the drilling is going on, the production before it gets to the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And people's personal well water on their home is being contaminated. It's really hard to prove in court because the laws that these companies are protected by the federal and state governments, to prove that these chemicals that are present in, or the concentrations of the chemicals are present in their drinking water, because these laws protect the particular chemicals being used in their fracking fluids to actually do the drilling for the natural gas. So, and drilling can affect a whole a water table, like an aquifer. So even if, you know, you didn't lease your land, if your neighbor, and I've, you know, met people who they didn't lease their land, their property was like 5 miles or 10 miles away from somebody else who leased their land, and they ended up with contaminated water. Otherwise, like, so water is a huge issue. With farmers, it could get into their fields, any sort of runoff or waste from drilling. You know, there's accidents that happen if they have livestock. You know, those, if they're, you know, if a creek is contaminated or a field is contaminated, you know, this could affect, you know, their livelihood, being able to raise livestock and sell it. And yeah, it's really disruptive to rural communities because it really, like, it could pit neighbor against neighbor, for people who want to run it through their land, or not. And if, but, And that pertains to pipelines more. So if one neighbor may not disagree, you know, with another neighbor who's on the same route, and, you know, this neighbor who's opposed to it has to sign a lease for this pipeline to run through the other neighbor's property who signed the lease, you know, they're going to be upset if they can't, you know, get the money they wanted to through their lease, since their neighbor is choosing not to lease. And so it pits neighbor against neighbor, even family members against family members. Some of these folks have had these properties in, you know, in their family for multiple generations. You know, they're getting disrupted, you know, even with recreational things, like folks are upset about if a creek gets filled up with sedimentation or slurry, it actually does become polluted. You know, they can't fish anymore. Migration patterns are like being screwed up. And, you know, there's a lot of different concerns and how it really negatively affects people in rural communities. And one more thing is originally, and I don't know how it is now with the presence of the New Milford satellite campus of Lackawanna College, of natural gas, the natural gas school that's a satellite of Lackawanna College. I can't remember the title of it, but originally we have a lot of out-of-state workers who were coming in, raising rent prices, and, you know, they're far away from home, they have a ton of money, they're in a new place, and there was a heightening amount of crime, you know, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, you know, things like that. So that was another concern for these rural communities that were generally quiet and, you know, everybody kind of knows each other. And all of a sudden you have tons of folks from out of state negatively affecting their area. So.
And yeah, and I guess the initial argument was it'll bring a lot of jobs to locals for, you know, within the industry, and there weren't locals that were trained to be in the industry, so that's why the out of state folks were coming in, as you mentioned. And I guess the Lackawanna College reference has to do with that program being put into place to educate the locals so that they can get those jobs, and that brings us to the economic part of this discussion. It does afford or offer people, locals, to make a lot of money, whether it be in working in the industry. You get a high, you know, get, as you mentioned, you get a lot of money. It's a high-paying gig. And also people who lease their land. There was an article today in the Scranton Times that they hit the $1 billion mark, they being locals who lease their land to gas companies. That's how much they've earned, $1 billion at this point. So that's pretty significant. The we go back to economics. We started there basically in the beginning of our conversation. That is the seemingly it is the most important factor to everybody involved. And isn't that a significant factor? When you balance it against some of the other things we were saying are not so good.
Yeah, it's definitely a significant factor, especially because that article referenced Dimmitt Township. They were, in the 2000 consensus, about 8.7% of their population was below the poverty line. I know many families who lived in Dimmitt, and, you know, when this happened, when they were kind of like the first area that, you know, fracking had started via Cabot Oil and Gas, you know, the residents there, a lot of them, you know, thought they hit the lottery. You know, many farmers can't even kind of maintain the cost of their property, and they're worried about selling their property eventually. you know, like subsidies for farmers got cut during the Bush Jr. Administration, and it has really negatively affected in the past, like, geez, how long is it now? Like almost 20 years, farmers and, you know, and a lot of families, like their kids are going away. They're not staying to keep up the family business because, you know, it's not making enough money. So when they, you know, when they approach them, when Cabot Oil and Gas approached them, it was just like a godsend. And I understand that, you know, and I understand Pennsylvania residents like wanting to have really good jobs and things like that. I just really wish that, and actually I say good jobs, but I mean, well-paying jobs. I should backtrack and not really say good, because I think it's a really dangerous profession to have, whether you're working on a drilling rig or you're working on a pipeline or a compressor station or like any step along the way. I think it could be very dangerous. And in the state of Pennsylvania, you don't have even protections if you work for the company, if you get into an accident, for chemicals to be disclosed, to see what chemicals were used in
the mixture.
Yeah, like in the accident itself. And it's just like the cases of water contamination, because these companies are protected from disclosing the information about the exact chemicals they're using and their fracking fluids. They're protected. And even if someone is negatively affected, if a worker is in an accident, they don't have to disclose those chemicals. And it has happened before. So I just wish there are, you know, ways to make a just transition from natural gas to renewable energies. You know, I don't know the exact way to do that, but I've been to some really great conferences where, you know, coal mining plants were being shut down in areas that really funded the community there. And they were making a transition to benefit everybody in the community, and union labor and things like that, to renewable energies, and, you know, in such a way that it'll benefit everybody in the community, and the community and labor and teachers have a way to negotiate what changes they want to see happen. So I definitely think we could create employment, you know, for people if we started, you know, especially we have to rework our whole energy infrastructure. Like, there would definitely be tons of jobs if renewable energies were, you know, being pushed more and taken seriously by our state and federal government. But I mean, the bottom line is, though, like, I you can't put, you know, a price on our resources, and, you know, just in a on a human level, you know, our drinking water, and our land and our air, and in the state of Pennsylvania, we're supposed to be protected by our Constitution. Those things are supposed to be protected by our Constitution. And unfortunately, the Department of Environmental Protection hasn't been really enforcing our Constitution. So
yeah, I think that's it specifically states that in the Constitution of Pennsylvania. You're right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you right now are working to try to balance this set of state of affairs by resisting some of the, in particular right now, we're talking about the Mariner East 2 pipeline, but generally you're trying to, as they say, shine a light on the whole industry, understanding the economic component and factors involved, and also the environmental and social issues that are also involved. One of the things you're trying to do to fund the many activities within this resistance is what you're calling a dystopian dance party.
Yes.
You're having a dystopian dance party, Charlotte.
Yes. Well, I just got the venue confirmed this morning, so I don't have a time. But this dystopian dance party, we're calling it Dancing on the Ruins. And it's, you know, anybody could show up in their favorite apocalyptic dystopian, like, outfit, you know, like Mad Max or Blade Runner, you know, whatever. but this will be held at the Keys. So it is a 21 and over benefit event. I don't have a time yet. This is on Penn Avenue in Scranton, but it's going to be on July 29th. The night of Arts on the Square. So it's a good stop, you know, after Arts on the Square. If you want to get a bite to eat and some food and then join the dance party or just hang out and see everybody's costumes and stuff. But this is going toward the White Pine Camp Legal Defense Fund because, like I said, they are expecting to... the sheriff's department to show up any day with this writ of possession, and they're planning to blockade the pipeline construction till the very end. Everybody's really dedicated to this, especially the Gerhardt family. So, yes, and this is through my union, the Northeastern Pennsylvania Industrial Workers of the World, our General Defense Committee. And we don't have an event up on Facebook yet, but we will post a Facebook event through the Northeastern Pennsylvania IWW page. And there will definitely be more info out there in the Electric City. I'm going to get the word out. But like I said, I just got the venue confirmation this morning, but I'm super excited. I think it's going to be a lot of fun and a great way to support their fight right now. Sometimes the... soul-crushing work, but I don't know, it's all worth it, like protecting our resources for multiple generations is totally worth it to me.
Thank you so much, Charlotte. Thank you for your hard work, your good work.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. It's so great to be on again.
It's always a pleasure. We'll have you on again.
Okay. Thank you. Enjoy your day.
Open wounds, wanna suck the poison out. Will you suck the poison out? And I would spread my wings if they weren't so goddamn heavy. Yeah, I would spread my wings if they weren't coated in honey. But I would wash your hands for you. I'm sure that I could get them clean. I won't be gentle anymore. I'll use expensive soap. I'll scrub aggressively. There'd be no more germs. You would be so clean. You would be clean. Clean. heavy. Yeah, I would spread my wings if they weren't coated in honey. Dirty is practical. All the girls leave you alone. When you're sticking to yourself, you don't want nobody else. And I would spread my wings if they weren't so goddamn heavy. Yeah, I would spread my wings if they weren't coated in honey. Up nests on your chest. We could live together there, never fly to anywhere.
A short article from the May 29, 2017 issue of the New Yorker magazine, written by Hallie Cantor, titled The Writer's Process. What's my process? Funny, I don't think anyone's ever asked me that before. I don't really have a process, per se. Just a simple routine that I meticulously follow every day, like a disciplined genius robot. I usually wake up around 5 or 5:05 a.m. and get out of bed immediately. I do not press snooze. I do not start scrolling through Twitter so that the brightness of my phone's LED screen will force my eyes into awakeness, but then continue reading tweets for so long that my eyes adjust to the brightness and I get sleepy again. I meditate first thing in the morning. I do this sitting down on a meditation pillow, which is not painful because I have naturally good posture. I do not use a meditation app because I am not a baby. I just set a timer to emit a gentle gong sound after an hour, and I empty my mind. When thoughts do arise, they are usually really smart thoughts about my writing, but I do not hold on to them in a panic because I have enough faith in myself to know that they will return when it is time. Then I run 10 miles and make a smoothie. I don't drink coffee because that would probably just lead to hours of wondering if maybe I haven't had enough coffee, but being unwilling to drink more because I don't want to get addicted and need more and more coffee every day just to be able to function. The smoothie usually has coconut oil in it. Yum! Finally, it's time to write. My desk is a clean, uncluttered expanse that I use solely for writing, and certainly not as a dumping ground for wedding invitations, gum wrappers, and grocery store receipts that I'm afraid to throw away in case I need them for tax purposes. On the wall above my computer, I have taped up an index card with a quote from Kafka or Dan DeLillo or some other cool writer,
which inspires me anew each time I look at it. You'd think that I would become blind to it after a while, or that I might occasionally feel embarrassed by its pretentiousness when guests come over. But nope. It's just constantly inspirational and not embarrassing. I remain seated at my desk for the entirety of my writing session. I do not attempt to convince myself that I could be just as productive if I were writing in bed, and that it would be kind of fun and like college. I don't need to disable my internet connection because, honestly, I'm not even tempted. I understand that social media does not hold the answers I seek, and that looking at it will only make me feel terrible. And what's more, my understanding of this fact translates seamlessly into my actual behavior. I have a friendly relationship with the mysterious forces that govern my creative inspiration, my muses, if you will. When they visit me, a soft smile alights on my lips. "Hello, old friends," I murmur fondly. My experience of writing is a giddy, pleasurable one, and does not feel like being trapped inside a cage that is on fire. When I write, I let my characters speak through me. I am but a vessel for their words. I shut out all distractions and turn off my phone, because I definitely don't worry that if I take too long to text people back, they'll decide they hate me and never text me again. In the afternoon, I typically take a long walk. I do not listen to podcasts. Why would I? The music of the natural world is podcast enough. As you may have noticed, a running theme in my process is that I am not afraid to be alone with my thoughts. Not at all. Of course, some days, the muses may not visit me. When this occurs, I accept the situation with equanimity and give myself permission to write a clumsy first draft and vigorously edit it later. This approach is possibly because I understand that my intrinsic self-worth is separate from my talent and my productivity, and because I know that I am deserving of love, even if my writing is not very good. This gives me the freedom to take risks, which in turn actually makes my writing very good. Funny, right? If I am truly stuck, I read a book. I do not watch a 22-minute sitcom as a, quote, break from the immense stress of waking up and sitting down at a desk. Not even if there is a new episode on Hulu of a show I don't particularly like but have seen every episode of. Anyway, I guess that's my process. It's all about repetition, really. Doing the same thing every single day. No one else in the world cares at all, yet I still do it. Because I, a human being, have the self-control to maintain this routine in a complete vacuum of social interaction or any positive reinforcement. Oh, and I almost forgot. I go to bed super early.
These are
wrinkle the silk cloth cover that hangs over the back of the deep black brown wood chair as it sets solid in the sun-filled dining room at the old family table, surrounded by three windows, trees through them, the four-dimensional concert hall of birdsong as the heat wave eases in. This morning I said hello to Bob Philbin as we walked our children to school.
I seem to recognize your face, haunting, familiar, yeah. I can't seem to place it. Cannot find the candle of thought to light your name. Lifetimes are catching up with me. All these changes take place. I wish I'd seen the place, but no one's ever taken me. Hearts and thoughts, they fade away. Hearts and thoughts, they fade away. I swear I recognize your breath. Memories like fingerprints are slowly raising. Me, you wouldn't recall, for I'm not my former. It's odd when you're stuck upon the shelf. I change by not changing at all. Small town predicts my fate. Perhaps that's what no one wants to see. I just wanna scream hello. And thoughts they fade, fade away. Thoughts and thoughts they fade.
And there you have it, episode 230 of Troubadours and Rock on Tours. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, the program's good friend, Charlotte, poet activist. Thank you so much for talking with us this week, Charlotte, and have fun at your dystopian dance party. I also like to thank writer Hallie Cantor and the New Yorker magazine, and these musical artists: Paul Pinto, Lucas Steele, Nick Chosky, Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians, Sloth Rust, 10,000 Maniacs, Pearl Jam, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard, too. Have a wonderful week, and hey, Martina, nice reviews. And yes, I'd like to make mention of one of our regular guests, one of the best playwrights in the country, Martina Majok just recently opened Cost of Living. We spoke about that a few weeks ago on the program, and it's really getting some great reviews. It's on the front page of the arts section of the New York Times this past Wednesday. You should check it out. It's at the Manhattan Theater Club right through July. Our compliments, Martina. Until next week, enjoy this week. Take care.